This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. This weekend marks 20 years since the September 11 terror attacks that killed thousands of people, with commemorations planned this weekend in New York, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. This anniversary comes less than 2 weeks after the U.S. officially ended a nearly two-decade-long war in Afghanistan. We start our show today to mark this anniversary with Glenn Prasser. He was a P&G executive on September 11, 2001, when his plane from Europe was diverted to Canada. This event inspired a Broadway show called Come From Away. Glenn, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate
it's our
it.
Pleasure to have you back. We last spoke when Come From Away was performing in Cincinnati,
right,
back when such things were still happening prior to
exactly.
the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's quite a gripping tale. And your story is very unique. For our purposes today, would you just talk a bit about what you were feeling when you realized why your flight was being diverted? You were returning from Europe and you were not going to be going where you thought you were. Instead, you were being diverted to Canada.
Yeah, information. The pilot got on the intercom about 4 hours into the flight. And whenever that happens, you know something's not right, because you typically hear from pilots right when you take off and right before you land. So he basically said that there was an issue with the plane, nothing major, but wanted to get it checked out. And we would be landing in Gander, Newfoundland. Really didn't think too much of it. But as we approached the runway in Gander, we noticed that there were probably 30 to 35 other super jets, jumbo jets, on the runway and on the tarmac. So when we saw that, we figured out that probably something more was going on.
But you did not know exactly what something more was?
No, we didn't. In fact, it's interesting. The pilot knew very little. And we later found out the reason for that is because the control tower was responsible for landing 38 planes in about 90 minutes. So there wasn't a lot of time for chit chat, and very little information was shared. And then we also learned that they didn't want to talk too much about it for fear of perhaps there being a terrorist on any of those planes that landed. In fact, the pilot, after we sat down, got on the intercom and said, if anyone has a cell phone that works, please see what you can find out. Obviously, U.S. airspace is closed, but we don't know much more about that than that. And so if anyone has a cell phone, find out what's going on. So I actually had an international cell phone. Remember, back in 2001, cell phones weren't all that prevalent. And cell phones certainly weren't set up for international calls. But because of my business travel, I had one. And I, in fact, learned after making a phone call what exactly had happened. And I went up to the cockpit, told the pilot, and he, in fact, handed me the microphone, and I updated the plane.
Oh, my gosh. So you were the one who broke the news to a lot of people on board.
Exactly.
Can you describe to us, because those of us who were around on that day and old enough to understand what was happening, what was that reaction, if you can remember the way the other passengers reacted to your news report?
Yeah, it was shock, bewilderment, and really, you know, just not having enough information. We're so used to turning on the radio, turning on the TV, and of course now with the internet, looking at the internet, but again, back then that wasn't as prevalent, but people really didn't have all that much information. Now that phone that I had actually worked out pretty well. A number of people wanted to make calls to notify their loved ones that they were safe and so on. So my phone was used by a number of people to make calls, and you know, it's interesting, as that was happening, I was just wondering, you know, how much is this all going to cost? But that wasn't important at the time. So one gentleman, in fact, came up to me and he had tears in his eyes. And he said, could I please use your phone? My daughter works in the World Trade Center. And I handed him the phone and he was fumbling around and he tried to dial it and he couldn't do it. So I took the phone and I asked for the number and got a hold of his wife. And as it turns out, she was okay, but it was a very emotional scene. And he gave me a big hug afterwards. And you know, thankfully, his daughter was okay.
I want to note that our guest, Glenn Prasser, will be sharing more about his personal story tonight at 7 o'clock at Xavier University at the Bellarmine Chapel. Again, at 7 o'clock, no charge for that, although the Little Sisters of the Poor, which is putting on the event, says they will accept goodwill donations gratefully. And Glenn, there is so much more to your unique story, because your plane was diverted away from the U.S. into Canada for security purposes, and you had to spend some time there. This was an event, and the response from the Canadians that inspired the Broadway musical Come From Away. Talk a bit about what that kindness from the Canadians felt like, and what perhaps we could learn today if we revisited that spirit.
Sure. It was something that I'd never experienced before in my life. The folks of Newfoundland, and this is something I learned after the fact, it's one of the poorest areas in Canada, and they're often the brunt of jokes from other Canadians. It's ironic, because in the 4 days that we spent there, you couldn't have been with people who were more kind and friendly and helpful. As an example, the first morning I was on the plane for 32 hours, so it was good to finally get off the plane. And we were sent to a church actually in Gambo, Newfoundland, which is about a half hour from Gander and a town of about 1,200 people. But woke up the next morning around 7 o'clock to the smell of breakfast, and this wasn't your ordinary breakfast. This was you could smell the eggs, the bacon, everything, including what we later found out was moose stew.
Yeah,
moose is a pretty big deal in Newfoundland. It's kind of like probably like cheese in Wisconsin. They make it every which way, and they don't buy it in stores. They shoot the moose and they freeze it and they eat it throughout the year, and it's a big deal. And the fact that they brought the moose out of their freezers and cooked it for hundreds of people they don't know or didn't know is I think a big deal.
And so how long were you there?
We landed Tuesday late morning, spent Tuesday night on the plane, got off the plane Wednesday, and then we finally returned to Cincinnati on Saturday morning.
This was one of those historic events that so many of us lived through in different ways, you in a very specific way. Can you share with us your feelings about returning home and being able to see your family?
Yeah, it was, I've done quite a bit of business travel, so we were used to being separated, and I'll be honest, getting back home, it was kind of like a normal business trip, because the breadth and what all happened, I guess, hadn't really sunk in, because we were somewhat removed from it, even though Canadian television brought in some TV so that we could watch it and so on. We could see that, but we were away from where most of the news activity was. So to some degree, I really wasn't as hooked into things as people who were here in the U.S. But it was certainly emotional when we did get home, one of the things I did, getting back to the telephone, I called Verizon and I told them that, wanted to thank them for having a phone that worked and how important that phone was to that airplane. And they checked and they said, "You're right, Mr. Prosser, you had over $1,400 in phone calls."
Oh, man.
And they put me on hold for about a minute and they came back on and they said, we're gonna comp you those $1,400. So
a lot of generosity you experienced in that period.
Absolutely.
I want to note, because we have to wrap, unfortunately, you are speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Xavier University. We've got details at wvxu.org. Glenn, thank you so much for sharing your story with us again.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
More to come after this. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's been 20 years since the terrorist attacks against the U.S. on September 11, 2001. The event shaped many of our lives, but for younger people, the memory is different. To discuss the legacy of 9/11, I spoke earlier with Nathan French, an associate professor in the Department of Comparative Religion at Miami University. Dr. French is also an affiliate faculty member in the Department of Global and Intercultural Studies. Here is our recorded interview. Nathan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me here, Michael. It's great to be here.
It's our pleasure to have you. It's been 20 years since the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and a lot of us are reflecting on what that day meant to us and what it has meant for our country. Of course, now there are full-grown adults who were born after the events of 9/11. They cast votes, and we're curious about how their worldview has been shaped by something that preceded their existence. From your perspective, what's different about America 20 years after that deadly day?
Well, I think I approach this as a scholar in the study of religion. And what I've seen, I was a senior in high school when September 11th, 2001 happened in Kentucky. I've studied across the country in that time in the course of becoming a professor. And what I've seen as a student and now as a professor getting to teach students about the day and its history is that 9/11 is in many ways a story that we have come to tell ourselves as a nation. The sociologist Robert Bella would think about it now as part of the fabric of our national civil religion. And the story, I think, has several chapters. The first chapter I would identify would be a sort of unity, a narrative of national unity in the face of the horror and suffering of the day. The second chapter would be a sort of resolve to win the wars, the October 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, the March 2003 invasion of Iraq, with the goal of bringing the perpetrators to justice in the case of Afghanistan and preventing the weapons of mass destruction program that Saddam Hussein was claimed to have had or was alleged to have had by the Bush administration. The third chapter, I think, sort of switches to mourning. And I think it's a sense of mourning those who were lost on the day, certainly, and teaching younger and younger generations of students about that, but also mourning those lost in the wars and a sort of turn toward what I think is the current chapter where we find ourselves now, which is one of frustration and loss. A lot of the polls that have been coming out in the last month or so really signal, I think, among Americans broadly, a sense of frustration with where the U.S. finds itself 20 years on, and a sense of what was lost, what values were given up, what wealth literally was given up in the wake of the wars. And I think students right now, amid this global pandemic, have a lot of questions about what 9/11 is. The other day in class, one of my students told me, when I hear my parents talk about September 11th, it feels like older history to me. It feels like history that I really don't have a stake in, that hasn't shaped my life. And I think that really opens the possibility for conversations like ours today.
Well, I'm curious about your own journey then, because if you were a senior in high school on 9/11, the events 20 years ago, and now you've taken a position in academia where your expertise is Islamic studies and Middle East studies, did those events shape your journey at all?
I think if you had asked me when I was in college at the time, perhaps not. The singular event that shaped my own academic biography was actually the July 7th bombings in London. At the time, I was at Centre College in Kentucky. I had done a study abroad program and had started some research on the question of violence and violence directed at states, against the United States, against Great Britain. At the time, I didn't know a lot about Islam. I didn't know a lot about Islamic studies, and I learned very quickly that I had a lot of learning to do. And I was very fortunate to benefit from the expertise of a number of scholars in Islamic studies along the way, most of whom encouraged me, first and foremost, as any good scholar of religion will tell you, to pay attention to the words of the individuals whom we're encountering. And I think that was one of the first sort of stunning moments for me. And it's a stunning moment for my students as well. I often lead my class off with, what did Osama bin Laden really want? What did he want to achieve on September 11th, 2001? And this has become all the more relevant right now, I think, as your listeners may be hearing stories about the possibilities of a resurgent Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. What did he want? And so often my students today can't really articulate that. They can articulate the causes of the Second World War, and they can articulate in various ways the goals of the Cold War or even the war in Vietnam. But when it comes to the last 20 years and bin Laden's goals on 9/11, they couldn't articulate that. And when I was a student, I realized that I couldn't either. And I think in part that's because our national conversation, at least as I experienced it, was one that discouraged closer examinations and evaluations of bin Laden's statements, his public statements, those broadcasts he would put on Al Jazeera and elsewhere. In part, the claim was that these should not be aired for national security reasons, but we didn't really start seeing his words in English, in print, in any sort of compiled copy until about 2005 with Bruce Lawrence's edited book, Messages to the World. And so for me, in beginning to understand what bin Laden sought, you begin to realize that the narrative that he was putting forward to those sympathetic to his cause was much different than what we had been hearing from policymakers and others. Bin Laden's hope on September 11, 2001, beyond any tactical and strategic objectives, one of the things that he latched onto in the post-9/11 era was he said he hoped that he could show the world American hypocrisy, that ultimately in his mind, the United States would follow one set of laws for itself and one set of laws for others. And as we sit here 20 years on and we reflect on the usage of torture and enhanced interrogation, when we reflect upon the U.S. withdrawal in Afghanistan, which many have been very critical of, we begin to understand where that narrative that bin Laden was incessant with begins to find purchase. And I think it allows us to really put the last 20 years in critical perspective.
We're talking with Dr. Nathan French, an associate professor of comparative religion in the Department of Global and Intercultural Studies at Miami University. Dr. French, I want to ask more about the students you see in class these days. And if they're younger students, they weren't even born when 9/11 happened. But some of the other themes that emerged in this country in the days, the weeks, the months, the years after 9/11 included this willingness for expanded surveillance. There's this nationalistic patriotism that still permeates our culture in this country. I'm wondering, how do those types of behaviors or actions by the government impact the way young students view this country today, which must be different than the way those of us who saw the transition take place?
I think when I speak with students about the last 20 years, they've grown up in a world very much different than the world that you and I grew up in. And that sounds perhaps a bit simple, but let me explain. Millennials right now, of which I'm part of that generation, make up the largest generation in the United States. And depending on how you date millennials, they were roughly anywhere between the ages of 5 and 20. On September 11th, 2001. But for most millennials, the idea of social media obviously didn't exist in high school then. The idea of owning a personal cell phone was very rare. The idea of owning a personal computer was very rare. Students that I have in class today have grown up in a technology-saturated environment. Screens have been part of their educational lives and their personal lives all the way through K through 12. The idea of having one's personal information, one's face, a journal of one's daily life, one's voice, et cetera, online for them is accepted. It's common. That was not something we really thought about after 9/11. And so the idea that information needs to have boundaries or be kept private or shouldn't be made accessible to the relevant authorities, for them is a very different question. My students laughed the other day when they found out that in the late 90s, when the toy craze of the Furby, I don't know if you remember Furbies, Michael.
Hey, I'm not that much older than you. I have a couple years on you. Let's tone it down.
Yeah. But it's this small, for the listeners who don't know, a small animal that would record what you say and repeat it back to you. There was a time when parents were really concerned about that toy recording their voices in private lives. And now, of course, in our homes, we have all sorts of Google and Amazon related digital devices that help us with our daily lives. So for our students, they take that sort of surveillance for granted. And the challenge I think that we face in the classroom is to open up for the students the ethical questions that emerged after the passage of things like the Patriot Act, after we learned about how the work of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Courts unfolded.
What about our relationship in this country to Islam? Because there was certainly heightened Islamophobia in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, it certainly still lingers to this day. How do you view the current relationship between America and that faith?
Absolutely, and that was that connects to the next point I was going to make about patriotism. When we use theories related to religious studies, anthropological, sociological, to think about patriotism and how it frames American society, patriotism was a very strong rallying point, but patriotism can also create communities external to who is considered a patriot and who is not, and to who is considered an American and who is not. I remember very vividly there was a cover that ran on The New Yorker around November of 2001. And I think the portrait was entitled "What So Proudly We Held," and it was illustrated by Carter Goodrich, and it shows a cab driver who appears to be wearing some form of headwear, perhaps a turban, hunkered down behind the wheel of the cab with "God Bless America" stickers and American flags emblazoned all over the cab. And I think that the artist captured a mood that was beginning to emerge among Muslim communities who had already started to see anti-Muslim violence post 9/11, some of that misdirected at the Sikh community, for example, and we're already beginning to understand that whatever this new bargain of what it was to be American was to be, it may or may not include Muslims. And on the one hand, we might say post 9/11 that things, in a sense, for Muslims have gotten better, in the sense there was a cover on Newsweek lately that had a number of prominent Muslim actors, celebrities, intellectuals, politicians, and others on the cover. But when I look at that cover for each of those individuals, I see stories that each of them have told very publicly about their encounters with anti-Muslim Islamophobia, anti-Black and anti-Brown racism in society. I think what I find when I have Muslim students in my class, almost all of my students have either personal experience or family experience of encounters with Islamophobic behaviors in the United States. It's an ongoing story. But I think it's important to note that that's not the only part of the Muslim experience. Muslims have thrived amid 9/11 and brought their voices increasingly into the American public sphere, laying claim to the conversation and forming, I think, in many ways, a conscience relative to American policy in countries where they themselves still have family.
What role do you think our connectivity plays in current views of Muslims, whether it be here in America or abroad, but the American perspective of that? We didn't have social media the way we know it now when 9/11 took place. So are we more susceptible to disinformation about people who might be different than us? Or are we more connected to people who are different than us, therefore we're learning more about them? Or is it some blend of that?
I think it's best to suggest it was a blend. The Pew Research Center recently published a poll asking Americans, dividing along left and right American political divisions, Democrat and Republican, as to whether these Americans view Islam as more likely than other religions to encourage violence in the years after 9/11. And from about 2009 forward, that gap begins to widen and widen and widen. In other words, there are more individuals identifying as Republican or leaning Republican who believe that Islam is more likely than other religions to encourage violence. And for those identifying as Democratic or leaning Democratic, the opposite, that percentage goes down. And I think in part that does speak to a polarizing effect that social media has had. But I think social media, as I noted, has also allowed a number of American Muslim scholars and American Muslim leaders to insist on the conversation, to ask America, has our conversation really changed? Do Americans realize that Islam has been in the United States for centuries, even before the United States was a country, were Muslims in the United States. Some scholars estimate up to a third of American Muslims were Black enslaved persons who were brought over to North America and continued to practice their faith. So I think in a way, while Islamophobia does seem to be increasing, so too is the push to insist that that Islam has a place in America. But I think there's another broader point with social media that it's important for us to note, which is how many Americans, particularly in the Midwest, in Ohio, in Kentucky, in Indiana, in Illinois, and even on the West Coast, experienced the day of 9/11. Without social media, most of us encountered the day sitting around our television sets. I ask my students to interview someone who was high school aged or older on 9/11 for class, and always the stories, especially from this area of the country, emphasize how we all experienced the day communally, but visually. We watched it unfold. And unless we had friends and family in New York and DC and in Pennsylvania, really it was a mediated and very virtual experience that we experienced in our hometowns. Whereas now with something like COVID, COVID is very much ubiquitous for us, obviously in our daily lives, but also in our social media presence. We can reach out and talk to friends and family. In the case of academics, they can talk to professors across the country about how they are dealing with the day-to-day life amid the pandemic. And I think that's very different than how 9/11 was experienced in this part of the country.
I want to talk about Afghanistan, but I want to remind our listeners we're talking with Nathan French. He's an associate professor of comparative religion in the Department of Global and Intercultural Studies at Miami University. When the Afghan war started all those years ago, it seemed that the enemy was the Taliban. And now the U.S. has departed Afghanistan militarily, and the Taliban is back in power. Can you help us understand what might be different about the Taliban this time around when we think back 20 years ago?
Right. I think this is a very important question. I was speaking with students the other day about the resurgence and the return of the Taliban to power. And I noted that, you know, when the fall of the Berlin Wall occurs and the fall of the Soviet Union follows, if we only relied on sources from 20 years prior, right, we would be relying on sources in the 60s and in some ways in the early 70s to try to make sense of what was happening in the Soviet Union and the former Soviet republics at that time. The same thing goes for here. Certainly, that doesn't mean we cast aside the histories we've learned of the Taliban 20 years ago. And in fact, there's researchers like Leah Farrell, in her book with Mustafa Hamid that helps us understand how those individuals who were sympathetic to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the 90s understood what Taliban governments was to look like. For today, I think it's important for us to remember that the Taliban is not a monolith. The Taliban is a cobbled together alliance of a number of competing interests, a number of competing generations. There are the older generations who remember the end of the Afghan Civil War in the mid-90s that erupted after the withdrawal of the Soviet Union in the late 80s. But there are Afghans today who are fighting on behalf of the Taliban and claiming allegiance to the Taliban, who are as old as some of our youngest military service members and have only known the American occupation and nation-building efforts in Afghanistan. And those can present different goals. Right now, I think the argument could be made the senior Taliban administration is trying to put forward that they learned their lesson from the late 90s and early 2000s, and they're offering this narrative to an international community, specifically to China, to Iran, to Russia, to try to shore up goodwill in their regional area and shore up international aid. The Taliban government is going to be facing severe famine conditions in the nation, likely a cutoff of international aid led by the United States. That's going to make governance very, very challenging. On the other hand, the Taliban, the leadership has to provide comfort to, has to provide aid to, has to provide support to, and meet the promises it's made to younger generations of Afghans who agreed to support them in their fight against the former Afghan government. That in and of itself brings a challenge, particularly if that involves religious commitments, because we know there are cores of the Afghan population still, as we see, taking to the streets to protest against Taliban government and demand from the Taliban the rights, the privileges, the education that they have enjoyed for the last 20 years. So I think it's important to remember the Taliban is finding itself in a very difficult position. It is looking to make regional deals and provide regional stability, but it faces challenges within itself. It has to uphold the alliances that it promised its supporters in its march to power.
I've only got about a minute left, Nathan, and this may be too complex a question for so little time, or maybe not, but what's the biggest threat to the Taliban at this point?
I think the biggest threat to the Taliban is delivering on the promises it's made to those who've supported it.
What could be the consequence, I suppose, if they don't?
Oh, the consequence, certainly. Well, so the consequence to the Taliban, if they don't follow through, could be the disintegration of this central government they're attempting to assemble. That is a re-descent of Afghanistan into civil war. It's the same set of events we saw unfold in Afghanistan at the end of the Soviet era, which again is why it's important not to set that history completely aside. But from 1989 to 1996, a civil war erupted in Afghanistan that was only ended by the Taliban the last time. Now the Taliban are going to find themselves in the position of starting as that government. Can they hold power? Can they hold off the famine conditions that are emerging against them? Can they keep the coalition that they've assembled or not? If they cannot, then I'm afraid the Afghan people, who have seen war off and on again since at least 1979, will continue to see that horrific suffering.
Dr. Nathan French is an associate professor in the Department of Comparative Religion at Miami University. He is also an affiliate faculty member in the Department of Global and Intercultural Studies. Nathan, thank you so much for the time you gave us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Michael. It's been a privilege.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.